nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology. You can follow along with this presentation by going to nanohub.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so we're going to talk about targeting nanomedical systems to single cells, and then if we're going to be able to assess something, as I always tell you, you have to be able to measure something in quantitative terms. So know whether you're improving your targeting or your targeting is getting worse. And so we'll talk about single cell methods. And some of those, again, depending on the targeting mechanism, may have to be very, very, very high throughput, either flow or imaging cytometry at single cell level. So we'll talk a little bit about both of those today. But first of all, let's start talking about targeting molecules. Now, I mentioned to you earlier that not all nanomedical systems that you'll see in the literature are targeted nanoparticles. Some of them take advantage of the leaky vasculature of tumors, and so you'll see that. You'll be looking around, where's the targeting molecule, and you won't find one, and that's because they didn't use one. The reason for that is that it's obviously hard to find good targeting molecules. It's nice to say that we have these types of molecules, antibodies, peptides, aptamers, and ligand receptors, but you have to know what is it going to bind to in terms of the biomarker. And biomarkers are not always readily available. So we're going to talk how that process takes place and then how you actually evaluate each of those. All of these targeting mechanisms, all of those molecules that I had in the previous slide, take advantage of molecular shape recognition. And this has taken on added importance now that we can make some pretty good shape predictions by structural biology techniques. And essentially what we're doing with all of these is we're recognizing a shape. Usually a unique shape is called an epitope in terms of targeting molecules. And a given receptor or molecule, which may be on the surface of a cell, can have multiple epitopes. And that leads to some interesting, both interesting possibilities and interesting problems, because different receptors on the cell surface can share epitopes. And that can really confuse what you're trying to target. And you have to be aware of those. And so there's some fairly, elegant techniques that you have for identifying things down to the level of an epitope to see whether you're going to be cross-reacting. So on this particular one, here I show specific recognition of a single epitope here. And then here is a cluster of receptors on the surface by which we may have specific recognition of multiple epitopes. We can also, if we have antibodies in particular, we can bind by the wrong end of the antibody, so-called Fc receptor binding. And that's something that, again, you need to know it exists. You need to know how to get around these problems, and I'm going to show you several of those during the lecture. You can also have non-specific recognition, and that will happen. It can happen because you may have very low avidity between your targeting molecule and your receptor, or you may overstain it. And we're going to talk about getting things at the right level for actually staining. So again, because you all come from different backgrounds, let's get everybody up to speed. I'm going to go through these topics. Where do antibodies really come from? Where are they in nature? There obviously there's antibodies in your body. And how do we make them in the laboratory? Some unique things about monoclonal antibodies, both advantages and disadvantages. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the therapy problems when people started to put antibodies into human beings and ran into some, in some cases, severe adverse events, including death. And then some solutions, at least partial solutions to that problem, so-called humanizing the sequences. And I'll tell you more about what that really means. And then lastly, why antibodies may not be a very good choice. Antibodies are pretty big. They're on the order of about 10 nanometers in size. So if you start thinking about how big those are, how much room they take up on the surface, if you're using rather small nanoparticles, they very quickly start running into each other, and the number of antibodies you can actually attach to a nanoparticle can be rather limited. quantum dots, you quite often can get limited to 100 antibodies or less. And that may not be enough to give you the kind of binding that you actually need. So how are monoclonal antibodies made? And most antibodies nowadays, not all of them are monoclonal, but monoclonal implies specificity for a single epitope. And that's important. Monoclonal, single epitope. And so what we do is we immunize with whatever that epitope is, and it may be a collection of epitopes, we immunize those into typically a mouse, and then those mouse cells are not immortal. I mean, you can't really grow them very much. So what you do is you actually form a hybridoma by fusing the mouse immune cells with a myeloma cell line, which is basically a cancer cell that grows with unlimited potential. You fuse them together, and what you hopefully produce is an antibody on the surface of these hybrid cells that corresponds to similar to the antibodies produced in your body by the plasma cells. As you go from B cells, and then they become plasma cells, and they start secreting antibodies in your body. So when you get a vaccine, you'll get something that will actually cause your non-cancerous B cells to be activated, and it's a complex process to educated to produce an antibody against that particular antigen or epitope. But if we want to make vast quantities of these, then it used to be that we had to produce this by immunizing one animal at a time. And when that animal died, then the next animal could be quite different. And so one of the things that's happened is that you can make virtually unlimited quantities of these by taking it from one animal, producing a stable hybrid cell line that can go on and become immortal. You can just keep producing this. And then there's several different ways to grow that. You can grow that by putting it in these fused cells back into the peritoneal cavity of another mouse and use the mouse effectively as a culture dish. But that is considered by today's standards to not be a very nice thing to do to animals. And in Europe, it's largely banned. That's so-called ascites. And when you actually look up antibodies that you buy commercially, they'll tell you whether they are produced by ascites or grown directly in tissue culture. They'll call it supernatant, where you just simply take the supernatant that's on a lawn of cells, and you then concentrate the antibody out of that. So this is the way, very, very, very briefly, how this is done and how we actually make monoclonal antibodies. Now, these antibodies themselves can be immunogenic. So if you take these mouse monoclonal antibodies and you put them into a human being, the human, you would recognize, your immune system would recognize these mouse monoclonal antibodies as foreign. And you would start to mount an immune response. And in some cases, when these were first put into human beings back in the 1980s, and we didn't understand this process very well, a number of people went into anaphylactic shock and died. And so that briefly, you know, this was thought to be the promising thing. We would just put monoclonal antibodies into humans to cure cancers and other such things. It turned out to be possible, but it was a little more difficult. So what we had to do was start, what we want to do is preserve the epitope binding capabilities here at the ends of the antibody. But the rest of the protein that's on here, the sequences are not as critical. And so you can substitute sequences that, so the rest of this antibody, everything outside the green areas on the tips here, so the rest of this antibody, you can make substitutions of amino acids on that antibody protein, which is what it is, it's one giant protein, and you can make them much more like what human antibodies would look like. So, and that's nice, that allows us to make monoclonal antibodies in mice. We can't really make monoclonal antibodies in humans. So this allows us to so-called mutagenize the sequences along here until most of the antibody looks like a human immunoglobulin and the tips still recognize the epitopes of interest. And that's called humanizing the antibody. And it's also considered a chimera, A chimera is a collection of two different things. So we actually have a mouse portion and a human portion when we finish this. And you see this one, a chimeric is sort of a crudely done one where we simply have just the tips are mouse and the rest are human. When we go and humanize it, we try to go and get rid of as many mouse sequences in green as we possibly can and just keep the absolute minimum. So somewhere between the chimeric form and the humanized form will be one that we can put into the human body without causing a large immune response. And that's what, as we've talked about and we'll talk much more about in the course, about the so-called antibody treatments for cancers, of which there's about 20 of them that are out there now. And that's what they've done. They have made essentially humanized forms of those original mouse monoclonals against the epitopes that belong to that particular type of cancer. Okay, also describing antibodies, you can imagine when people first started making these, everybody made their own monoclonal antibodies, and they gave them their own, whatever names they wanted to, and it was basically an impossible collection, and nobody knew whether their antibody was equivalent to someone else's. So they may be similar, they may be slightly different, but they're really identifying the same epitope, and that's what you really want to know. So what happened is we actually had, and it's a periodic international conference that's held, to determine new cluster designations. And they basically group or cluster all of the antibodies that have that identify the same epitope. So that's what a cluster designation means. Now, what that means is that if you have a, for example, here against CD3, implies cluster designation 3 implies it's against a human T lymphocyte. Okay, and CD4 and CD8 are helper and suppressor subsets of T cell subsets. Some of the antibodies against cancer, for example, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma has a antibody out there which is given routinely to patients called rituximab. And it's against the CD20 molecule that appears on the surface of all of the B-cell lymphomas of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cancer. So, but there may be many different forms of that. So if you actually go, there will be a CD3 designation, and then they will have what's called a clone descriptor. So, yes, they're all CD3, but they're different clones, and every clone is unique, and they don't all behave exactly the same. And so you'll see that people who get very particular about targeting, they will look not only at the cluster designation, but the specific clone. They'll find that some clones work better than others. So I want you to be aware of that, and when you look things up and you try to buy an antibody to put onto a nanoparticle, you need to know these things, because they're going to expect you to be able to go through and choose which, not only cluster designation, but have some idea of which clone you might want. And the clones, if the paper is written well, the clones should be specified in a scientific manuscript that you read in the literature, but not always. One of the first things that happened was that people started exploring particularly leukemias and lymphomas, they discovered that leukemias, for example, are like immature forms of blood cells, blood cell types, and they would have very unique collection of different molecules on the cell surface. And so what they would do is they would actually so-called immunophenotype by taking multiple monoclonal antibodies, each one against one of those epitopes, and what they would do in cluster designations. And then they would look at the expression of that antigen on the surface, antigen or epitope, on the surface of a cell as a function of the maturity of the cell. If you start with very primitive stem cells and you go to very mature cell types, so along this axis, and you look at the relative number of molecules on the surface of the cell, on this one, what you'll find is, if, for example, in this one, antigen 3 is expressed very highly back at the primitive stem cell stage, but its expression level drops as the cell matures. Antigen 2 has an expression which is initially off, but then gets turned on and is expressed during sort of this intermediate life stage of the cells, but then comes off again. And antigen 1 is only very lowly expressed back at the primitive, say, stem cell stage, but is gradually going on until it reaches some kind of a maximal number as the cell is very much matured. Now, if you start putting these things together and you start realizing that every time you have two lines intersecting or three lines intersecting, you're going to start getting unique points. So people started saying, well, if I have high levels of antigen 3 and high levels of antigen 2 and low levels of antigen 1, then I must be at this stage. And it turns out that each of the leukemias and lymphomas that are known, and there are over 200 different types of cancers just with those alone, are defined as a cell which is almost in a frozen state of differentiation, where this cell right here in a cancer cell stays and then it multiplies itself over and over again. It never grows to be a mature cell. What happens with most cells as they proliferate, their proliferation starts slowing down as they differentiate into more mature cell types. Many types of cancers do not do that. They just stay in a more primitive type and they just reproduce very, very rapidly, lots of copies of themselves. So pretty soon those copies of those cells take over in the bloodstream, and you end up with many cells stuck in this level of maturity that shouldn't be there. And so we will treat, for example, in this particular case, you might have high levels of CD20 on these cells, and you'll go along and you'll try knocking out the cells which are expressing that. And there are some more subtle things to that. You can get much more complicated as you start to getting into, literally into stem cell research. My group has done quite a bit of this over the last 25 years. You'll see the early markers, cluster designation CD34 is a fairly early stem cell marker on normal cells. And interestingly enough, a lot of these early stem cell markers that occur on normal cells but are lost as the cell matures stay on these cancer cells. So many cancer cells have stem-like markers, which is why people have come, it's a rather bad misnomer, I think, but they call them cancer stem cells because they share many of the characteristic cluster designation epitopes of the cancer stem cells. So this, you can see this gets quite busy, all the different levels going up and down, in some cases even being expressed at two different times during maturity, turned on, turned off, and then turned on again. But that's very unusual. Most of the time, it either goes and decreases or increases. And then in some cases, you'll notice you'll see a little C, small c, CD3. That implies that it's in the cytoplasm rather than on the cell surface. And that's important because if you tried targeting at during this stage, you would never see these cells because this is expressed in the inside the cell rather than on the cell surface. But you can make very complex maps, and people have done this. So one of the things that I want to warn you about, because people always think that monoclonal antibodies are better than polyclonal antibodies, monoclonal antibodies can sometimes be too specific. And some amino acid sequences, a monoclonal antibody can recognize on the order of 6 or 7 amino acids long. That's a pretty small sequence. And that amount of sequence is shared by many proteins in a cell. And so one of the things that people get very confused in is they'll use antibodies that look very good on Western blots of proteins where you lay all the proteins out on a grid. The problem is when you do flow cytometry and you stain those cells, you don't have them separated out on a gel. They're going to all stain together. So that's where the choosing the right antibody becomes really important, because if it doesn't say flow cytometry certified, And that means it probably cross-reacts with epitopes on a whole bunch of other parts of the cell. And you're going to end up with very, very confused results. So these are just some warnings on this. Okay, let's talk a little bit about immunoglobulin structure, how it actually works. And you'll notice that there are different regions. Here's the antigen combining regions here. And you notice that there's sort of two segments pulled together and joined, and everything is joined by disulfide bonds here. We have the so-called light chains, and we have the heavy chains. This is really all that we need. We can actually cleave using various enzymes. We can actually cut off the so-called FC portion tail, which can, this is what I told you before, can bind non-specifically to the surface of a cell when the antibody sort of binds backwards by its tail rather than its head. If you use pepsin as an enzyme and cleave it, then you'll end up with still what's called a divalent binding condition. And the problem here is this can bind onto one protein, this can bind onto a different protein, and start pulling the proteins together. And when you do that, you start moving molecules around in the cell surface. What happens is they start so-called clustering, patching, capping, clustering. And what you cause is a biological reaction, which quite often leads it to internalize those receptors. And you may not want to do that because cells have interesting ways of reusing the same molecules over and over again. And when those receptors are taken inside, they actually initiate an action. Now, I'll give you an example of that. For insulin receptors, you may or may not know this, but it's not the insulin that turns out that's actually important. It's the insulin receptor. So when you bind insulin to the insulin receptor on a surface, on the cell surface, it causes the insulin receptors to cluster, and then the receptors get taken inside, and it's the receptors that actually do the process that you're trying to get the insulin to do. So insulin itself can be a rather nasty substance and has some very bad side effects. So people are taking advantage of that by finding other things besides insulin that can bind to insulin receptors and actually take it inside. So we can chop up. The point I'm trying to say is here, if we take a papain cleavage, we can just get, this is called an FAB fragment. So we have two FAB fragments. This is called an FAB2 fragment. And then the whole immunoglobulin, and there's many different types of immunoglobulins, is the entire structure. So you have to decide what's best for your purposes. Now, how would you know what is best? Well, if you're trying to hang other molecules onto this, like you're trying to put a fluorescent molecule onto something like this, if you do that, it's so close to the antigen binding site that you can only put a very small number, typically one or two, which is not a very good number to put on this. If you start putting more than that, then you will start basically causing the antibody to lose its recognition for the epitope. It's better to put fluorescent molecules and attach things down on this portion. But then you've got to take care so that you don't bind by FC receptors, which happen to grab on to this end of the antibody. And many cells, some cell types have a lot of FC receptors. We can take advantage of that antibody structure in a number of ways. I'm just going to review very, very quickly the concepts of direct immunofluorescence, indirect immunofluorescence, and so-called biotin-avidin labeling to be able to detect things. And this is sort of this gets you thinking about the ways that you do nanoparticles. And before we do that, let me just say one more thing about the attaching a fluorochrome or anything else onto the antibody. If you buy fluorescent labeled antibodies, you have to recognize that it is a Poisson binding process. They actually don't, when they actually attach fluorescent molecules to antibodies, it's a somewhat random process. They can't control and put exactly 4, 5, or 6 molecules on there. They'll actually get a distribution that'll look like this. So why do I say that low, this is a, like, for example, low fluorescent to protein ratio. This is a bad one because you notice it has in some cases, a very high proportion which has zero fluorochromes attached to this antibody. The antibodies with zero fluorochromes are going to have much higher specificity than the ones with 2, 4, 6, 8, or 10. In fact, as you go out further and further, the specificity tends to get less and less. So this is telling you, when somebody says, oh, we have the brightest antibody, well, it may be the brightest antibody and it may lose virtually all the specificity for what you're trying to label. So brightest is not best. But dim is not best either, because in many cases, these ones will outcompete, and you'll say, I have a FP ratio of, say, one, you know, of one, meaning that's the average in the Poisson distribution. And what I find is I stain my cells, and all of a sudden my cells do not stain with anything that has fluorescence on it, because the unlabeled is outcompeting the labeled. So you want to stay in some mid-range. Typically 4 to 6 is a good range of labeling. Okay, and also, particularly when you're doing in vitro experiments and actually staining things, if you put, you want to be in so-called antibody excess. You want to have more antibodies than you have antigens. You want to be in that condition. But if you have too many, then you will drive the reaction, and you can stain anything with an antibody, and I do mean anything, if you put enough of it on there. And what people tend to do, particularly when they have fluorescent antibodies, they like to see things that are very bright. And I tell them, if it's really bright, it's probably overstained, in which case now the fluorescent intensity goes way up, but it's totally irrelevant. It's staining everything. If you get to the point where don't have enough antibody, and this is, you know, you're trying to save money, you want to cut back your antibody usage, and all of a sudden you so-called fall off the curve, and you end up, what you're trying to get is something where your fluorescence is proportional to the number of things that you're labeling. And all of these things that I'm saying here, I'm talking about general immunofluorescence staining, but these all apply to nanoparticles that you're binding to cells. So you want to be in a range in the middle here where it doesn't vary very much, the amount of binding of the antibodies or the nanoparticles, and stay here. And that may look like it's a simple thing to do, but when you start treating cells, both not only in vitro but also in vivo, you can actually induce receptors to be produced on the surface. And we had some, when I was doing some early work in this field, we actually were causing, using hematopoietic growth factors, we were actually causing these antigens to be produced in much higher numbers on the surface, and we fell right off the curve. So that led to some interesting things with reviewers trying to explain to them why we use the antibodies at a different concentration for the treated cells than we did for the control cells, because we were trying to stay in this region. And nobody knew that back then. They still have a tough time with that one. So you've got to think about what this is. Now, most of the time, the problem that you have, if you're trying to do a concentration-driven process, you have the problem in the body that you are going to be constantly down in this region. When we make nanoparticles that circulate over and over again, then we have the advantage of driving things more into this region at the same, with the same amount of nanoparticles. The longer we can circulate, the more we can try to produce an ideal situation in here. Normally, if you just take antibodies, they go through and they go rapidly through the body, and they're going to be lost. And so you have to drive it with a drug concentration reaction. And that's why that doesn't work very well. This is what people do in vitro, but in vivo, it doesn't work very well. So here it just shows you, here's an example of direct immunofluorescence. It's the simplest, where you put your fluorochromes, or in this case, you could take your nanoparticle directly with an antibody directly on it, which goes to the antigen. So this would be the easiest way to be able to make that connection. If for some reason you can't do that, then you start seeing, for example, in this particular case, you can have controls for which you have a nonspecific antibody, where you put the same antibody on with the same, roughly the same number of fluorochromes, and that's not easy. You say 3 here, but remember that's a Poisson distribution. And you try to take your non-specific antibody that labels something else. It's supposed to label this antigen, but your non-specific control labels this antigen. And you see sort of what your specificity is. And here you're binding by the Fc portion. Now, this may seem a rather simple thing, but trying to find a proper control for an antibody is a very difficult thing because it's most of the time they're making it against something, and the question is, does it cross-react with what you're actually trying to do? So that one, that's not as easy as it sounds. Indirect immunofluorescence means that we don't mess with the primary antibody. We don't try to stick any labels directly on it. We simply use a secondary antibody which recognizes the primary antibody. And we have a couple of advantages in that. That gives us greater flexibility on what we can do out here, but it also gives us an amplification factor. We can start building structures and get a relatively large increase in signals. However, as you notice, things get more complicated with the, you still have to do all the controls. The nice thing is that you can still put in an irrelevant antigen, an antibody against an irrelevant antigen. Now, people, you'll see this a lot in the literature when people are rapidly prototyping. They will take an antibody and they will attach a biotin molecule to it. That's the simplest thing possible if you want to actually label something. And labeling biotin on nanoparticles is a very common thing. And that's great, except for the fact that in vivo we have a lot of biotin floating around. And if you have a lot of dividing cells and you're going inside cells, we have a lot of endogenous biotin. So that can get you into trouble. It's a rapid way to prototype things because biotin is an almost indestructible molecule, and it's very easy to use and to conjugate. And avidin, the avidin affinity for biotin is even stronger than most antibodies are for their antigens. So you can buy avidins with all kinds of fluorochromes. You can buy them with metals in there. You can buy them with all kinds of structures. So it's a very rapid prototyping. If it works for you, it's the easiest, fastest way. What you do have to do is put what we call a molecular spacer arm on your biotin. And this we do this routinely also with nanoparticles. If we string a biotin on it, we have to put a number of hydrocarbons out there to give our cells on the order of about 12 to 14 carbon spacing so that it hangs out and three-dimensionally can link up with the avidin molecule. Otherwise, it's in too tight and the avidin can't get to it. So we have something called steric hindrance where the avidin can't get close enough to the biotin to bind. So you'll see molecular spacer arms that you can buy biotin with molecular spacer arms and even activated groups that go on the end that you can very easily conjugate it to a nanoparticle or to an antibody. So what are some of the complications with antibodies? Well, first of all, non-specific binding to dead or damaged cells. That may not sound like a problem, but I'll guarantee you, even for in vitro experiments, the best preps that you will ever have will never be better than 99%, 98, 99% viable cells. And dead damaged cells will bind just about any antibody, regardless of what the specificity is. You got to titrate. You have to think about whether you have to chop the antibody up like I showed you with the enzymes. You have a big problem with antibodies being taken up by phagocytic cells. They will eat antibodies, and I've mentioned that that's a big problem and one reason why the antibody treatments for cancer have some problems, because if you just put those antibodies into the bloodstream, the macrophages and to some extent monocytes in your bloodstream will eat those, the neutrophils, and really eat them, and then you end up with a patient with severe neutrophil deficiency who is prone to infection and can die of infection. So then they have to boost the neutrophil growth factors. There's a lot of other things such as receptor recycling. Things can go in and activate other things inside the cell, so you have to be very, very careful. And this last one, I just want to, again, if you think about an average antibody is on the order of 10 nanometers or bigger in length, that's pretty big. If you start, most of the times our nanoparticles are are 10 to 30 nanometers in diameter. So there's a very finite amount of surface area. And only a fraction of that surface area can be have linkage groups so that you can actually attach an antibody. So at some point, that becomes pretty large. And also, the steric hindrance factors, just getting it to be out there and available to bind, can be a challenge. And so therefore, while it's makes for rapid prototyping, it has a lot of problems, particularly in vivo. And I don't highly recommend it. What's happening now, a lot of people, there are peptide sequences which can mimic the antibody, and they can be very small. And I'll show you some of those in an upcoming slide. So the peptide can also recognize a shape. And we've come to using peptides as small as 6 amino acids that can actually have a recognition for an epitope just about as strongly as an antibody. And I'll show you some examples of that. How do you find these peptides? And that usually involves a screening process and some kind of a high throughput, because most of the time these amino acid peptides are made by combinatorial chemistry. So the person who finds it first, that's a lot of work. The nice thing is when they find it, they get their name on a publication, and then you can go to the publication and you know exactly the sequence. So you don't have to do all of the combinatorial chemistry and all of the screening, high throughput screening, and then you can just use that peptide. But that's what science is all about, is that we stand on each other's shoulders to get to the next step. So I'm going to show you an example of that. This particular one is look how small this sequence is. So we have 7 amino acids here that was produced as a random peptide phage library. So a lot of bacteriophage expressing this, and then screening that. And quite often what they will do is they will actually pan onto a surface, so an affinity onto a surface, and just roll the fluid over that and try to collect it. That's the simplest way to do it, and then gradually enrich that. So they tested this, and they found out that this particular sequence would target to a cell surface biomarker on this SKBR3 breast cancer cell line, which is one of the ones that we happen to be using. What they didn't know, and we use this particular peptide on a quantum dot nanoparticle, we found that not only could we label the quantum dot to then target to this SKBR3, but that it had another interesting property, that it actually would pull the nanoparticle right across the cell membrane. And it would do one thing further than that. Remember, I've told you that targeting inside a cell is a very big universe almost compared to the size. These are not to size. This is about 1/1,000,000th the volume of that. And so it's a big world in there. We found out that this same, believe it or not, this same 7 amino acid sequence that targeted to the surface, took it across the cell membrane, also retargeted to the nucleus of that cell. That's a lot of, you know, if we think about our concentric model of layers of a nanoparticle, that's the equivalent of this doing 3 layers. Cell targeting, cell entry, and intracellular targeting. Okay? That's pretty amazing for one 7 amino acid sequence. There are a lot of sequences known. And this just shows you a number of these experimental controls. We have where we put the amino acid sequence on a quantum dot and then had a cell line which should be negative. Now you can see here that it's really not negative, it's staining. Here's one that it should be positive, and it's staining virtually all the cells in here. And then there are ones that you can buy, so-called Q-tracker. People use quantum dots. What did they do? They actually took a peptide sequence that binds to almost any cell type and takes it inside the cell. So those first two steps, so that people can very rapidly label cells with quantum dots. All right, so here's an example where it just labels everything. It doesn't care if it has that sequence on the surface or not. And it will go for all different cell types. So when you think about how do you do a control for that, one of the things that you really need to think about is of seven amino acids, what's the proper control for that for a peptide targeting molecule? Well, it turns out that what you really want to do is scramble the sequence, make a random sequence. But you have to check databases to make sure that your random sequence control doesn't bind to something else. So you have to go through databases and find out one that actually serves as a true control for targeting. Now, peptides are still, they're better than antibodies, I would say, in general, because they're smaller. You can design them to be not very immunogenic. But one thing that is starting to gain in popularity, and we've done some work in this area, is so-called aptamers. And an aptamer is basically a DNA or RNA sequence which actually can fold and it can recognize shapes, again, just like an antibody or a peptide would. Now, what are some of the interesting advantages of that? We didn't understand this until recently, but it turns out that your body and your bloodstream is constantly getting rid of cells, and the DNA from those cells gets chopped up in random lengths and so on and is floating around in your bloodstream. In fact, people are detecting tumors by proteomics, proteomic-type methods, by actually looking at DNA that's floating around in addition to proteins and looking for specific sequences. But it turns out the important thing is that RNA and DNA is something your body is used to seeing, so it's really not very immunogenic at all, and you don't have to worry much about what sequence it is. So it has that nice advantage. There's another very nice advantage of aptamers, and that is you can take that aptamer, which is a DNA sequence, or RNA, and you can, if you wanted to, PCR amplify. In other words, do in vitro amplification of that strand of DNA. So you could have a single strand of DNA, and you could make a million copies of it and detect it. And you're going to have an upcoming lecture for one of my graduate students, who's be graduating here shortly, so she's a pretty senior graduate student, and she has been developing a so-called nanobarcoding structure. So actually using aptamer-like structures to encode information and then actually do PCR amplification of that sequence so that you can detect a single nanoparticle. So we'll see how that can be done. But the basic idea is that, and again, these aptamers, there are aptamer databases, and I'm going to show you where you can look this up, where Andy Ellington at the University of Texas has got essentially the world database repository for aptamers. He's one of the best in the field. We've published one paper with Andy, and he keeps up on this constantly. So you know what those sequences are. Once you know what those sequences are, that's even easier to make an aptamer sequence. If you know the sequence, it's much easier than even doing a peptide sequence. Easier and cheaper. So, again, I've given you some of the database, the links to this, to the Ellington Lab aptamer database. Again, if you're lucky enough to have a known aptamer sequence that'll recognize the particular biomarker on the cell type, that's a very good way to go. And again, you can also go in and use that as a PCR amplifiable probe. So, if you're not lucky enough to have the right sequence, and we were not lucky enough to, for the particular thing that we're looking at, then you have to do an aptamer library screening method. And we actually worked out a way with combinatorial chemistry to actually do a particular type of synthesis such that we displayed different aptamer sequences on polymer beads, and then we're able to create libraries of those polymer beads, vast libraries, so that we are actually able to look at up to 100 million sequences in a day by high-throughput screening. I'm going to show you that very quickly. I'm just trying to tell you this because making an aptamer, if you're going and finding a known sequence, that can be a very challenging thing. If the sequence is known, it's easy. They've done all the work for you. You can stand on their shoulders and take things to the next level. So we actually made beads. This particular one is a thioaptamer, meaning it has a sulfide group on the backbone that changes it a little bit. produced by combinatorial chemistry. And this shows you one where this was sort of the bead of interest we're picking out from the background. We started out, believe it or not, just to test the concept, actually picking beads up one by one. Okay, you can imagine that was not something the graduate students liked to do. Very painful, working with a micro injection type device, picking these things up one by one and then testing them. And of course we did this so that they weren't rare. We weren't looking for one in a million or anything like that, but we had to test the concept. But the idea being that you may have to screen millions of them, so obviously picking them up one at a time is not a very good idea. And what we wanted to do is check something that we knew that we had that would work. We had two different thioaptamer sequences that we knew that we could basically construct within the library, and we knew so we could test when we got through with this. So we did an in vitro combinatorial selection process and created these vast libraries of beads where we could again and again synthesize sequences. Now, the interesting thing is that by the time you go through a lot of different rounds of sequences, then there are going to be certain base pairs in common, and you're going to be able to check the ones which have the highest possible binding frequency. So some are more avid than others. And you very quickly get into some very, very large library situations. So we actually went through a whole sequence of events here. I won't bore you with the details, but starting out with so-called one peptide libraries and then one molecule, and then one oligonucleotide sequence on each bead, and then eventually where we were starting to screen, people wanted to make libraries of libraries. And when you start making a library of maybe on the order of 100 million or a billion possibilities, then you have to get kind of creative. You have to start doing libraries of libraries. But this shows you how it went, so-called split synthesis methods. And there are people here certainly capable of doing this here at Purdue. And the person that collaborated with me in Texas actually came from Purdue. So we did this work together. And you see we get a pretty large library, 100 million here. And you start coming up with, and then you start thinking about, if you really want to get a very large library, you can have libraries of libraries, where you might have 10 to the 8th libraries where each bead has a million different sequences on it. So you start subdividing the work and walking it down through. So this shows you the high throughput screening process and the whole process of making a library. You can even do these beads on here using multi-TOF mass spec. And then you can start screening these. You start coming together. Here's the actual screening process. You can go through it. I've given you these papers, so you can go through it in much more detail. And you end up with something that looks like this by flow cytometry. So we actually took the two subunits of NF-kappa B, which is a very important molecule for many things, including cancer. And we actually were able to test that by flow cytometry with different colors on the beads and select out the beads, and then we basically pick the winners. So we do this combinatorial library screening. Says you look at all the possibilities, you find that you pick out the ones that work, and then you go back and you sequence it to find out what those successful ones that work, what the actual sequence was. So you do it the same way nature would do it, if you will, and you can do a lot of, as I say, compress a few million years into a few days worth of work. We can also, we've talked about other types of targeting molecules. I wanted to mention this one because this is one that in particular we have at Purdue, a fairly famous group in Phil Lau's group, and Endocyte, which is a spin-off company from that, now testing, doing clinical trials in human patients. And what they discovered, and I gave you the 2002, one of the landmark papers from that, was that folate receptors are expressed usually in a much upregulated fashion. So you have on cancer cells. So you have many different types of cancers have lots of folate receptors. Now, the only problem with that is that all cells will have some folate receptors. That's problem number one. Problem number two, it's difficult to have anything to test in vitro, because anything you grow in vitro is going to express the folate receptors quite differently than what they do in an in vivo situation. But the challenge of this is that what you've got is what we call a level sensitive detection. So you have more folate receptors on a cancer cell than on a normal cell, as opposed to what you'd really like to have is a unique marker that's only on the cancer cells and is not present on the normal cells. That's the ideal situation. When you start having it where you have some and then more, then you've got a problem similar to sort of a pharmacokinetics problem where you've got to get the concentration right. Because if you put a lot of the nanoparticles with folate receptors in there, then what will happen at some point is you'll start binding to normal cells. You'll, at a furious pace. If you titrate back similar to that antibody antigen titration curve, if you're in the right place, then you'll tend to bind only to the cancer cells, which have a lot more, folate, receptors. But that's a balance. So you've got to get the exact dose right. So that is the challenge of this. I'm not saying it isn't a good approach, and they're certainly doing some very nice new therapies with that. But recognize that as a challenge. You've got a level sensitive detection as opposed to all or nothing. All or nothing is obviously a lot easier to target the cell disease cells and not be hitting the normal cells. You get into the level sensitive, you got to be more careful, get the concentrations, doses, work out the kinetics of egress of the body, how much is going in and how much is going out. Things get a whole lot more complicated, but it still works for many things. So this just shows you have ligand receptor targeting with the folate receptor for many types of things. This shows you the whole process out of that. This is taken out of that paper from Phil Lau's lab. And this has been done on some human patients and is in clinical trials. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the assessment of targeting and mistargeting at the single cell level. We have to get something that's quantitative if we're going to walk our way in and get things so that we know that we have the best possible targeting. We have two things to assess. We have specificity and sensitivity. And those are two things that can be a real challenge to get both of them at once. You want it to be sensitive enough that you can get, particularly for rare cells in a diseased, like a metastatic cancer cell in the body, to be able to have high sensitivity to detection. But the logical thing to do that, to get high sensitivity, is to flood with more nanoparticles. If you flood with more nanoparticles, at some point, you may interfere with the specificity and start overdosing and then hitting some of the normal cells. So the challenge is to be able to get things at the right level there. So the way I say this is that single cell nanomedicine, and that's what I've been saying over and over again, nanomedicine is single cell medicine. That's very different paradigm than organ level medicine, which is mainly what we do right now, tissue and organ level. Now we're down to single cell, and it requires good single cell assays. And typically, the two most common ones you're going to use are flow cytometry or image cytometry, where you can actually look and count, and not only count the cells which are specifically binding, but figure out the types of cells which are non-specifically binding. You'd like to know that when I go after this cancer cell, oh, by the way, it's also going to bind to that monocyte over there and cause, you know, potential problems in infection for the patients. So you need to know that. So we need to quantitate at single cell level. That allows us to look at population heterogeneity. You always have heterogeneity in vivo, all the different cell types. We have very artificial situations, and it's amazing, and I want you to see that when you go out in the literature. You'll see people test their targeting using a cell line, and they say, see, it targets. I put them on there, and they bound to that cell type, and they don't show you any other cell types. Okay, so how do you know what the mistargeting is going to be? So you need to be asking those kinds of questions. And all real cell populations are heterogeneous. They're heterogeneous in development, in different types. You've got all of them there. They're constantly expressing biomarkers up and down, and you've got to make sure that you don't cause some bad cross-reactions. And then again, I mentioned that all of the, it's always, in vivo targeting of nanomedical systems is always a rare event targeting situation, where you're literally looking for the needle in the haystack, the one cell in a million type frequencies quite often, unless you were to put the nanoparticles, if you were to put them directly with a local concentration, if you knew where to look, you can go and there are some situations, where you can do that, where you can prejudice the local concentration. But if you're putting it in the bloodstream and saying, go find the cells, then it's always going to be rare. And you're going to need to look, at fairly rapid measurements and measure a lot of things. Okay. Most of these methods, these so-called cytometry single-cell methods, also allow you to measure multiple measurements per cell. So we can look at all of the unique properties of the cell. We can see, as we saw developmentally, you can say, is that a stem cell? Is that a more mature cell? What type of cell is it? It may be on its way to becoming a B cell, but it's an early B cell as opposed to a late B cell. We can look at all of those things if we can measure multiple parameters per cell. And then those multiple measurements we make quite often reveal the biological mechanisms. And this is something that's revolutionized cell biology. Virtually every major cell biology group uses things like flow and image cytometry to be able to make multiple measurements, because they're starting to see what initially by eye looked like a few different, for example, looking at human blood, you would think there's only a few different cell types there, as opposed to hundreds of cell types that you can define using monoclonal antibodies against specific cell surface antigens expressed during development. So it gets very, very complicated. Okay, and you took a visit in the last class. We went to the flow cytometry and cell separation facility, which is here for Purdue. It's here for you. It's also a CTSI, that's the Clinical Translational Science Institute for all of Indiana, which includes IU, Purdue, and Notre Dame. And so we've got a lot of unique things in there. The flow cytometers I'm going to talk about first, and then I'll mention a little bit about some scanning image cytometry that's also available for you. So what is a flow cytometer? The first thing to think about a flow cytometer is it's really just another type of fluorescence microscope. And if you think about the analogy of a sort of a virtual slide, instead of having cells stuck onto a slide and looking at them on a microscope, if we have those cells single file flowing one at a time very fast, typically on the order of 1 to 10 meters per second past a laser beam, and maybe as high as 40 meters per second. They're in a laser beam for anywhere from 10 to 100 millionths microseconds, 10 to 100 microseconds, and we're making a whole series of different color measurements. So we can have different color antibodies, and people have done up to 17 colors simultaneously as these things are flowing through at more than 100, let's say more than 100,000 cells per minute, and they're measuring 17 colors per cell and then dividing all the different groups up all in one pass. So it's a tremendously powerful technology. And think of this thing, if you can understand a fluorescence microscope, how many people here use a fluorescent microscope? Okay, about half, okay. So this is just another form, but again, as I told you before, looking through a fluorescent microscope, your eye is the human eye is not a good detector of the total amount of fluorescence. So you can detect see about a difference of a factor of 2 in brightness, and you would argue about that. You'd say, well, is this one brighter than that one? And if it was less than a factor of 2 difference in brightness, you really couldn't tell, and you might have some other arguments, just because you're all different and your sensitivities are different. In this, we can do that 100,000 cells per minute and see 1% differences in fluorescence and do it highly reproducibly, very, very fast. So we start seeing a lot of the true biological variability. And when we measure that, we measure that typically if we measure one property, molecular property 1, let's say, for an antibody, we get a distribution. But you're used to looking at distributions and thinking, oh, here's the correct measurement, and these are errors around that. And I'm saying, no, that's not true. This is the biological variation. The error bars are so small, you couldn't even put them on here. Okay? They're very, very small error bars. So these really are different than those and are different from those cells. This being the number of cells having a particular amount of fluorescence here, for example. Now, this would be the average if you did a what we call a bulk cell measurement, and the mean value of this, the arithmetic mean. Now, you could also have two populations, and if you were just making a bulk cell measurement, you weren't measuring the cells one by one, you could not tell the difference between the distribution that had a bimodal distribution, two completely different cell populations. These would average out to being the same as that mean, but they're very, very different. Now, if you look at that and you say, wow, that's quite a difference. Now, if I started measuring properties, this is molecular property two, if I measure simultaneously, let's say one color fluorescence here, like green fluorescence here and maybe red fluorescence here on this property, I might find that this distribution, which looked like one distribution all collapsed down on top of itself, that's what this distribution looks like. If all these points were brought down on this axis, it would look like that. And if you look at this other axis and you brought this down, you would have something that looked like this. Two properties. So you thought, oh, I have only one measurement, and it's a variation around that measurement. Or I have only two. And now I've shown you by measuring both of them simultaneously, correlated on a cell-by-cell basis, I didn't have one or two. I actually had four different populations of cells. So people will quite commonly think, because they look at these things, they tend to think in these terms. Now, if you can do this with two parameters at a time, think about what you do with three. Think about what you might have with 17 different parameters simultaneously. You'd see all kinds of cell subpopulations that you never knew existed. So it's an extremely powerful technology and is opening up, you know, whole different areas of biology. Now, what can you measure with cytometry? Well, you can measure intrinsic properties, but those are kind of hard. Sometimes there are specific proteins produced that may have some kind of an autofluorescent spectrum. Most things are extrinsic markers, meaning we put antibodies or fluorescent folate to bind to folate receptors. And most of the things that we tend to do with antibodies are structural. On the other hand, we may want to measure the metabolism of a cell. And there are many ways that we can measure functional properties. We can literally measure enzyme metabolism in a cell. We can measure reporter gene generation as a functional property. So structural and functional, you need to think about what types of things that you're trying to measure. So this is very, very powerful. You can put together combinations of measurements. And we have a very sophisticated flow facility here. So if we think about trying to take our nanomedical systems, we can do some very first estimates looking through a fluorescent microscope, typically. We can try to look at that and get an idea. We should always do that first. But then we can go and look at a flow cytometric way and assay both the specificity and the detection level. So here's what a flow cytometer looks like, and you saw that in a previous slide. If, in fact, we actually take that stream and vibrate it, literally typically with a piezoelectric crystal, and vibrate the stream of, turns out it's a salt, typically a salt water solution, then it starts breaking up into droplets. And I want you all to go home tonight as part of your assignment and go take your water faucet in your sink and have a very narrow stream where it's starting to undulate and go into droplets and just start tapping very gently at a rate and see if you can get it to break off at some fixed distance. And that's what we're trying to do here. If we have this, and this is, you all have inkjet printers, and this is just inkjet printing technology, except that instead of ink, we have cells inside. So here, what we do is we actually have a saltwater solution. If we find a cell, we take the measurements out through here, go through the electronics, decide what we want, we can come back and say, all right, send a radio frequency pulse. And that's really all it is a radio frequency pulse, which causes the ions to go up or down, the positive or negative ions to go up or down so that the last droplet that's still connected is either positively or negatively charged. We put it down through some electrostatic plates, typically at about 1,000 to 2,000 volts, and then we literally pull the droplets one way or another way, or if they're uncharged, they go straight through, and we can very rapidly, this is a way to sort, as I said, very easily sort 100,000 cells per minute. And if you do really, really high speed flow like I have done, I've done this at 100,000 cells per second. So you can do some, you can collect some serious numbers of cells here. So this is the cell sorter part. Most of the cell sorters in existence are based on inkjet technology, but we're starting to produce microfluidic cell sorters that actually do it down microchannels. And so we're doing magnetic sorting with magnetic beads on the cells rather than detecting the fluorescence. So we can also do that, but there's many different ways that this can be done. This just shows you all cell sorters. I, for many, many years, taught a very advanced level course, graduate course in flow cytometry and cell sorting. And what I told them from this diagram is every cell sorter in the world is built like this. This is like, if you understand the basics of this, then it's like a rental car. You can go anywhere in the world, and you know there's going to be a steering wheel and brakes and some lights and directional signals and a few other things. They're going to be on every single car you would rent. These things are going to be on every single flow cytometer. And all you got to do is say the equivalent of, where's the steering wheel? So you know what it is if you understand how these things work. So they're all very similar, and yet they're done in a lot of interesting different ways. Let's finish by discussing a couple more things about confocal analysis. Image analysis can be also done at very high levels inside a single cell. And we know that that's important for all your targeting because you need to do intracellular targeting. Did it go to the nucleus? Did it go to the mitochondria? Where were you trying to target this? And we can have amino acid sequences are known that will take your nanoparticles to virtually any part of the cell you want. And you can put those sequences on your nanoparticles to get it there. And then you can test that three-dimensionally. Now, you can't test a large number of cells, so you have to be a little bit more. But what you're doing with confocal 3D microscopy is you're effectively optically slicing the cell, and you're doing that. There's a variety of different ways. Typically, it's done with a pinhole so that only one of these planes is in focus at the same time. You do have problems with photo bleaching, so sometimes people will use not a single photon but a multi-photon such that they can make the energy very precisely at one place in a cell, like my spot that I'm showing here right now, rather than driving it completely through the cell. So there's lots of different ways to do that, and we have some very sophisticated multi-photon confocal microscopes here at Purdue and in this building. What kinds of measurements can we make? Not only want to measure targeting, but you want to say, you know, first of all, properties of the cell. Did I get it to the right cell? Did I affect the cell? I want to measure not only once I got the nanoparticle to the cell, did I cause the cell's behavior to change? Did I cause the cell to go into apoptosis, programmed cell death? Did I cause it to proliferate or to shut down proliferation? If I'm, for example, trying to stop metastatic cancer, I can do a lot of those things. All of these things, sort of a laundry list here of items I can measure. I'm not going to go through all of them, but just pointing out, we can certainly measure the cell cycle stage that used to be done very painfully with tritiated thymidine uptake and autoradiography. We can now measure DNA cell cycle at 100,000 cells per minute. Very, very easy. We can do a complex immunophenotyping, many colors. We're doing right now a lot of reporter genes, so we can do even multicolor reporter genes. You can have several genes that you're turning on simultaneously and do two or three color reporter gene expression. You can measure enzymes. You can measure metabolites. Look at calcium, pH. You can do, this is not, most people don't know this, but you can actually, if you fix the cell, typically you can go inside and look at signal transduction pathways. And you can also see if proteins are phosphorylated so that you can look at gene expression assays at single cell level. There are antibodies that can tell the difference between a phosphorylated form of a protein and a non-phosphorylated form. You can measure things like membrane potential, very, very important in neurosciences, viscosity, cell viability, and many, many, many parameters. So there are more than 50,000 different papers in flow cytometry currently out there that have been published around the world. You can measure, typically light scatter is used as a trigger to show that you have a cell of interest and get rough sizing of cell. Most of the time we measure fluorescence. That's the most common thing and the easiest thing. Some people, a few of us, have measured things like fluorescence polarization. That's a little harder. And you can measure duration of signals so that you start getting some spatial information about that. Here are some fields, clinical, both biological and clinical applications using flow cytometry, a wide variety. This is only a partial list. We're doing now some plant science using plant protoplasts. People have done marine biology, put flow cytometers on boats, taken out looking at marine plankton. Toxicology assays. I mean, it's a very wide range of fields affected. It was considered one of the most important technologies of the 20th century and was recognized as such recently. So we can make very rapid measurements on single cells. We can make multiple simultaneous correlated measurements. What's the disadvantage of flow cytometry? In general, we don't get an idea of morphology, okay? Except for simple things like cell size or nuclear to cell size ratios. And we can measure only isolated cells, but sometimes you can't get isolated cells. Now, I have a little asterisk here because we're now starting to do imaging in flow. So we're actually doing high-speed imaging as the cell goes through. It actually have a camera and taking pictures of the cells. And there are commercially available ones here. They don't, at present, don't have sorting capability, but you can start taking pictures of cells. Advantages of image and confocal, you can see morphology even within tissues. You don't have to separate the cells. You can show location of a probe inside. You can make multiple colors, and you can relocate a cell of interest. The minute you get something, the positioning devices are so good now, they're down to, literally nanometer type stepping motors, that you can get back into the same position and look at things multiple at different time points, which is a disadvantage in flow cytometry. You basically get one time point. It's hard to get a large number of cells, so you have to be careful what you try to measure. It's difficult to get quantitative measurements due to fading problems, although there are anti-fade solutions that you can and should use whenever possible. If you use something like a quantum dot, you can irradiate them at high intensity for an hour, and it doesn't make any difference. They won't photobleach. And cell separation is a challenge. Here are some things, challenges of rare event. Non-specific binding, when you're starting to find one cell in a million, and you've got so that's one in a million, and then you've got one in 100, maybe, or dead damaged cells. How do you find that out? There are ways to put irrelevant antibodies on and to distinguish between a damaged cell and a specifically binding cell. I did a lot of that work about 30 years ago, and showed that this could be done. Very small cross reactions can become very important. Things that people never see. Flow cytometry on a 10% subpopulation, you can be pretty sloppy and you can get away with a lot. When you go to one cell in a million, you can't be sloppy. Everything has to work right at the same time. People ask me, what's hard about rare cell analysis? I say, everything has to work right at the same time in the same experiment. There's very few cells. Think about if you have a handful of cells, maybe 100 cells or fewer, and you maybe have them in eight-color data space, so eight-dimensional data space. How do you find them? It's a very, very difficult problem. I spent 10 years of my life inventing some new methods of data mining in high-dimensional data spaces to see these. And then processing the numbers of millions of cells that you need to have adequate sampling statistics. And I'm going to come back to this again, but it turns out that people are either over or under sample things. By the time you get about 50 cells, and that's in you know, we discussed that a little bit. It's in one of the papers that I gave you to read. About 50 cells of a particular type, you can back calculate what the frequency is in the parent population, and you can come up typically with a 95% confidence limit statistically. But if you try sampling 5 cells, you're never going to be able to do that, and you're going to get a very incorrect answer. We can process enough cells very, very high speed. We can enrichment sorting, and go back and collect these cells. This shows you a very rare cell, but then after a single pass, it's a 33 1/3% purity, going from one cell in 100,000. We have the LEAP interactive imaging system, and Tricia Eustachio is the student who's going to give you a guest lecture in coming weeks on her nanobarcoding, but she's also an expert on this LEAP instrument. And here what we have is a plate-based, an image, I showed you that. It was moving with robotic structures across with an inverted phase fluorescence microscope. And what you can do, and I'll play this a couple of times so you can see it, is that we have So we have a laser beam, we have galvanic mirrors that are flipping it like this, and then aiming at the cells and literally getting rid of all the cells not of interest. So you can do this with this is sorting attached cells. So people say, I can't do flow cytometry because my cells have to be laid down into a tissue format. I say, fine, use the LEAP instrument and have it go through and simply, again, make the measurements. So it'll make measurements and it'll produce histograms and scattergrams just like the flow cytometer, but then you can also get rid of all of the cells of interest. And if you lay back with less energy than that, then you can opto-inject, like a single cell electroporation, you can laser opto-inject small molecules into individual cells, and literally one cell and not opto-inject its neighbor. So that's another thing that is possible with this technology. And you can clone down to single cell. So let's say you sort 100 cells off the sorter, and 50 of them are of interest. You did an enrichment sort. How do you get those 50, or let's say there's 20 out of the 100 that are really the cell of interest? And you've got 80 non-specifically staining that you can see by imaging that those are the wrong cells. So you can go back and you can zap those cells, not that were the incorrect cells, and get to 100% purity and manipulate 100 cells or fewer. And we've done this quite successfully. So you can go from the sorter to the LEAP instrument, and then you can end up with something like this. This is where quantum dots were put inside, opto-injected inside individual cells. You see, we're getting them inside. And then we can eliminate the cells which did not have any opto-injected. Now think about that. This is showing it with nanoparticles, but the same thing would be done with a drug. So we can get purified cells which only have the drug delivery. Okay, I'm going to wrap things up now. I've given you a lot of reading on this. This first one is on rare cell analysis. Know that exists. At some point, that may be important to you in your work. I laid out a lot of things. Some things are a little easier to understand than others, but I tried to make it very readable for biologists who didn't know much about flow cytometry or engineering or whatever, and then more sophisticated aspects of this. And you can see here about actually putting molecular biosensors in with multispectral confocal microscopy. So these are all some papers and some LEAP experiments. So please look through those papers. You have PDF copies of all of them, and I hope that also further makes the lecture understandable. I had to go through this pretty fast today, but you should know a lot more about targeting now. Okay, I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have. Everybody understood everything. Wow, you're smart. Well, I knew you were smart. You had to be. You're at Purdue, right? So, any questions? Okay, if you don't have any questions now, you can email me or save them for next time. You're going to need all of this targeting that you will have to target in your design for your nanomedical system. So start thinking about your project and what kind of targeting you're going to use. Okay.